Thursday, May 21st, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael. The producer is Josh Salem, and our engineers are Ray Bodwell and Hannah Francis. Special thanks to Brett Pivoteau, Isabel Charlet, Crystal Blair, Alex Gonzalez, and Brian Bull. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Street Roots Managing Editor Karina Brown to talk about one of the latest stories from the paper. It's called Snowed Under. Summer is fast approaching. One 2023 death reveals how Portland's emergency systems leave homeless residents vulnerable to extreme weather. Welcome to the show, Karina.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So this new story is by Jeremiah Hayden, and it talks about a Portlander who died in the snow in 2023 and what that instance tells us about how Portland's emergency service dispatch works. So let's start with that February 2023 snowstorm. What was Portland Street Response dealing with during that time?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, a classic Portland sudden snowstorm where the streets are filled with snow and clogged with cars. People are abandoning their cars. Traffic is terrible. So, you know, it was a lot to get across town. Still, in this incident, you know, the man who died, he waited 4 hours while five different people called 911 to report that he was lying in the snow, partially naked, and just really needed help immediately. So Jeremiah wanted to take a look at, you know, why the city's emergency response system tasked Portland Street Response with, like, what appeared to people working in the van that day as a medical emergency instead of just sending paramedics who were really just a couple blocks away in the fire station.
What did he find about how that came to pass?
Well, one major thing he found is that there's a couple of ways that the city just really hasn't kept up with best practices that other cities who have alternative emergency response systems like Portland Street Response have put in place. And one of those, the major things, is having triage call centers embedded in the emergency dispatch headquarters. So that means people trained in, like, mental health, behavioral health, and also nurses, trained nurses, who are embedded within the emergency dispatch call center, who can help to route those calls to the proper place. So, you know, in a case like this where a man is facing a medical emergency, you know, they might have sent paramedics instead of Portland Street Response. So, you know, what he found actually was that the city is aware of these best practices. In fact, city leaders, including the Bureau of Emergency Communications Director Bob Causey, were part of this group of leaders who traveled to be a part of a Harvard, like, government performance lab that was all about learning best practices for alternative 911 emergency response systems. So they were working, this was, you know, city leaders traveling to Harvard to work on site in collaboration with other cities in order to understand best practices. And one of the things presented there was a 2024 study that looked at an alternative emergency response system in Washington, D.C. It's called the Right Care Right Now program that has an element with this nurse triage program within dispatch, like I was talking about. And what the study found is that that nurse triage program meant that the proportion of calls that actually required sending an ambulance dropped by nearly half. So that's because, you know, nurses were able to determine that ambulances were actually not necessary in almost half of the cases. So dropped from 97% of calls to 56% of calls. And then additionally, calls resulting in, you know, where people actually had to be transported by ambulance once emergency responders were there, that dropped from 73% to 45%. So as you can imagine, that really takes a lot of pressure off of emergency responders like Portland Street Response, who would otherwise be kind of zigzagging across the city for calls that might not even require them. It also works in reverse, you know, making sure that calls are routed to paramedics when necessary. So, you know, city leaders are aware of this kind of best practice, but it just hasn't been implemented here in Portland. Although Multnomah County Behavioral Health does embed a behavioral health caseworker at the Bureau of Emergency Communications at BOEC, who works with clients over dispatch. So that's a program similar to what could be used for medical emergencies.
You mentioned some of the ways that Portland and Multnomah County could change the emergency dispatch system to avoid situations like this, but going into the causal aspect of why this call got stuck at PSR for 4+ hours while this person was suffering, what are some of the policy level constraints that led to this happening?
Well, according to a former Portland Street Response employee who was in the van that responded to that call that day, there was really a lack of clarity on what Portland Street Response workers were supposed to do when they were faced with, you know, multiple calls, including one that appeared to require response by paramedics. So this former worker who spoke on the condition of anonymity said that they really, you know, talked to several managers actually that day saying, hey, this seems like a serious call. I think it needs paramedics to respond to it, and weren't able to push that call back. So the city, you know, says that there is a clear policy where workers like this worker can talk to their supervisor in that kind of situation, and then the supervisor makes a determination on what should happen. But this worker said that in practice, it's just simply not, you know, that clear, that there's politics involved and just like difficult decisions. Obviously, this was like a very difficult day that taxed, you know, would have taxed any like policy and procedure. But it just kind of makes clear how, you know, in these most severe moments when Portlanders are their most vulnerable, especially those living on the street, how there really needs to be like clear policy for people to follow.
Yeah, I was interested to see it connected to the political place that PSR, especially in 2023, represented, being a more fledgling program, and also how it connects to the shortage of personnel at the Bureau of Emergency Communications.
Yeah. You know, which the city says is in a much better funded position. Now there's far fewer vacancies in the emergency communication system now than there was then.
And just for clarity for our listeners' sake, could you remind us, Portland Street Response includes what sort of responders if paramedics aren't necessarily folded in?
Yeah, it does include, you know, an emergency medical technician is part of, you know, the personnel on hand when Portland Street Response responds to calls. However, it's not that person is not a trained paramedic, and the van does not have the kind of like medical equipment that an ambulance would have.
Yeah, and that would be needed to respond to somebody who's getting hypothermia in the moment. I'm curious, off of this investigation and digging into some of the best practices here, How does Mayor Keith Wilson's plans to expand Portland Street Response, how does that play into this picture?
Yeah, I mean, he proposed in his proposed budget, Mayor Wilson wants to pretty much double the current Portland Street Response budget. So that would bring it to over $10 million. That would add 14 full-time positions and increase the hours by 4 hours a day, the hours when Portland Street Response operates. So right now they operate between 8 a.m. and 10 p.m., but with this increase in funding, they would be able to operate between 6 a.m. and midnight. It would also mean they would be able to equip 16 vans, which would be staggered throughout the day. That doesn't mean 16 vans would be out on the streets all the time. Like, for example, now the agency has 11 vans, but their goal is to at least keep two operating at any time. But even that doesn't quite always happen due to, you know, staffing and people needing time off.
We're going into summer now. Does this limitation and the system that we've been talking about in our emergency response system, does it present concerns with the possibility of heat waves in our future?
Yeah, I mean, I think it presents concerns for any extreme weather, which obviously we all know those incidents are increasing with climate change. And really, you know, people overall underestimate their vulnerability to extreme weather. We can all be more at risk based on the number of extreme weather events we are subject to, how long those events last, and whether any of us have access to relief from them via, you know, either heat or air conditioning or places to cool off and warm up. And then there's also like age and pre-existing conditions. So, you know, I think in Portland, it seems like a mild climate, but it's just there's much more risk involved now and ever increasing kind of than ever. So, you know, we really need these systems to be available when we need them. So those extreme weather incidents are the times we need them most. And especially people living outside facing a lot of risk from repeated or, you know, longer duration events like the heat dome or snowstorms like this.
What do you hope folks take away from this story? Or what is the impact that you hope it has?
I think, you know, Jeremiah's reporting just showed how it's not enough to simply have a program like Portland Street Response, although, you know, it's great, has shown a lot of great outcomes. But we really need to be following best practices that, you know, cities across the country have found are necessary to implement alongside those programs.
If our listeners are interested in reading this for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
Listeners should track down a vendor that there are dozens of vendors across the city selling the paper. So get the print edition, buy it from a vendor. And if you miss this story, it'll be out tomorrow morning, Wednesday morning, out on the street for all week until the following Wednesday. If you miss it, it'll be online too. But really, for the full impact, get it in print.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't mention?
I don't think so. I think that's it.
Well, Karina, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That was Street Roots managing editor Karina Brown speaking with me about one of the latest stories from the paper. It's called Snowed Under. Summer is fast approaching. One 2023 death reveals how Portland's emergency systems leave homeless residents vulnerable to extreme weather. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm David Chittenden. Today is the marathon budget session at Portland City Council, and many Portlanders showed up to testify on the amendments the City Council is considering. The city has a major budget shortfall it's seeking to fill in, and there are a number of proposals on the table. There are at least 126 amendments under consideration. One amendment proposed by Councilor Steve Novick would close the Community Music Center and the Multnomah Arts Center to fund parks maintenance, a department that's facing big cuts. Another amendment would cut the city's allocation to its economic development arm, Prosper Portland, for the year. Still other amendments seek to move some funding allocated for Portland police to help fill in other gaps in the budget. Here's some of what Portlanders have to say.
Hello, my name is Travis Johnson. I'm in District 2, North Portland. I'm a father of three young children. I'm here to urge you to vote no on Amendment 45. Amendment 45 would close funding for the Community Music Center. My seven-year-old son, Daniel, has been attending the Community Music Center for the past 2.5 years. He just performed in his fifth concert just 2 weeks ago. And what he's getting there goes far beyond music. He's grown in focus and confidence and joy, and it's become a place where he really feels proud of himself. This is my four-year-old son, Nicholas. He can't wait to start next fall when he turns 5. And we've already been practicing at home for his orientation in fall. For my family, the Community Music Center is our only path to music education. We can't afford private lessons. Probably know it's very expensive to get private lessons. And so closing these centers, closing Community Music Center, would mean closing the door to music, not just for my children, but for countless working families in Portland like mine, who have nowhere else to turn for affordable music education. So please vote no on Amendment 45. Please keep the Community Music Center open, and let's keep music alive in Portland. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Karen Sumter. I am a Portland resident in near Rocky Butte. I'm just here to speak against Councilman Novick's amendment to close down the Multnomah Arts Center. I have been going to that center ever since I came to Portland 8 years ago, and I am aware of what a tremendous benefit it is to the community, especially to a lot of the underserved part of the community. It's a wonderful resource, and I very much hope you can find some way to keep it open. Arts are as important as other actors in this city, and it is, as I said, a wonderful resource for the community. I can't say enough about how much it has meant to me in my life, and I hope you will consider keeping it. That's all. Thank you.
Go ahead. Excuse me. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Rachel, and I'm here also to speak on the closure of the Multnomah Arts Center and the Community Music Center. My children have participated in both, and I participate. I was not able to find any arts programming, especially in the ceramics field, that was under $350 to $500 a class. I looked for 10 years. And this has been an opportunity for us to be engaged in a community. We're in an incredibly diverse body of people. We have access to elders, and those elders also depend on this center. There's a senior center there. I don't know if there are plans for something that would replace it, but I know that they rely on community and senior services that they get there, as well as all of those of us who rely on the arts programming. The loss of this would be huge to the community in terms of, I believe, community health, equity for those of us who can't access other things, and also despair, which causes a litany of other health and social problems that would come. I don't think it will equal out. There is no private sector, nothing that can contribute as much programming that's already here and sustainable. And the taxpayers have voted here and spoken that this arts programming and access to it and equitability is important for our city and important to all of us.
I'm Dana Grigsby. I live in District 4. I want to also rise to oppose Amendment 45, which would close the Multnomah Arts Center and the Community Music Center. My family has found so much value there. My son went to preschool there. My older child took their first ceramics class there and now has a partial scholarship for university because of that art background that was nurtured. I myself do drawing and ceramics now as well. There is no other resource in Portland that can meet the needs of the community that has built up around the MAC. It is so intergenerational and so intersectional in so many ways. The elders who I make ceramics with share on a daily basis. The community is so strong. And for that to be just disposed of with what felt like so little notice. Only a few of us were able to come today to testify because this news only actually got out on Friday. So I suspect there's a lot of written testimony about this. I encourage you, I implore you to visit the MAC before you make a decision like this. It is not something that can be replaced easily or casually. And if you don't have a plan to support the arts in Portland, it will cost in so many ways. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Gracie Campbell, and I am here in response to the potential closure of MAC and the Community Music Center. I'm here today to urge you to sustain the programs at MAC and CMC, no matter what you do with the buildings. I understand the buildings are a budget drain. I'm a student at MAC, and I'm keenly aware of how profoundly my life has been uplifted as a direct result of the classes there. These two facilities house incubators for hundreds of people from toddler to senior to congregate, to participate in artistic expression. The arts programming at these centers fulfills important functions for all of us. Engaging with art is a safe and supportive in a safe and supportive environment, stimulates the brain's ability to adapt and form new connectors, and is absolutely crucial to mental health. Mental health is no less important than physical health. Good mental health is currently a crisis in our society, including Multnomah County. These centers' arts program enable us to learn new ways to express ourselves, to slow down, experiment, and to share our individual perspectives and to understand others' perspectives. We learn to look and listen at others' unique ways of expressing themselves. This brings us to a greater understanding, compassion, and cooperation. No matter what our differences, through the arts at MAC and CMC, we are building a broader sense of community in challenging times. I urge you with my heart not to put them in jeopardy. Thank you.
Greetings, counselors. I'm Jamie Partridge. I'm a retired letter carrier in Northeast Portland, District 2. I speak in favor of Councillor Green and Dumphy's amendment to reallocate Prosper Portland funding. Public dollars require public control. I've lived on the inner east side of Portland for the last 57 years, and I've seen Prosper Portland, formerly Portland Development Commission, use tax dollars to fund urban removal, programs that have displaced Black and low-income communities. Since its rebrand in 2017, it has presented itself as a champion of equity and wealth creation for underserved communities, but it continues to operate without meaningful public oversight and prioritizes wealthy interests over the common good. The Council Green and Dumphy's amendment eliminates the city's annual allocation of general fund dollars to Prosper Portland, roughly $13 million. And redirects those resources to community priorities like maintaining parks programs. It also directs Prosper Portland to use a portion of its $50 million strategic investment fund to fully fund all of its ongoing programs for the next year. This amendment does not cut any programs Prosper is currently offering. It simply directs Prosper to tap into its own slush fund rather than relying on general fund dollars needed to shore up critical city services. Thank you.
My name is Micah Meskel, and I'm representing the Bird Alliance of Oregon and our 10,000 local members. I want to acknowledge and appreciate how difficult your task is today and into the future, and I really appreciate the collective effort in finding innovative ways to maintain services, especially in the Parks Department, which provides so many services to the community and the collective environment. Many of your amendment proposals center on the continuation of important park services and the necessary maintenance that will benefit all of the community. Today, I really want to draw attention to a very problematic amendment proposal that, if passed, would have huge negative implications on the city's efforts to protect and equitably grow the city's urban forest. Councilor Zimmerman's Amendment 2 and 3 would have a catastrophic impact on the city's effort to protect and plant trees across the city's entire tree program. It puts implementation of programs at risk that would increase tree plantings in East Portland, as well as efforts to reduce the cost burden of tree maintenance on all of Portlanders. It also significantly reduces the city's tool to protect the existing tree canopy. I urge you to vote no on Zimmerman 2 and 3, and you'll hear from many other tree advocates. Alternatively, I want you all to instead consider concepts like Avalos 1 and 2, Green Dunphy 4, Dunphy 8, Canal 4, Maria 1, Novick 1. And lastly, with Councilman Novick's Amendment 8, as a, I'd like you all to consider that as a last resort to fill the park's budget and to really follow the PSEF committee's lead in co-drafting that ordinance.
My name is Lydia Kiesling, and I'm a District 3 resident, mom of two young kids in PPS, and a member of Portland DSA. I'm also a writer and last year reported on Measure 110 for The Nation magazine. I had the privilege of speaking with many experts on the issues of homelessness, substance use disorder, and mental illness. I learned a lot from them about the ways Oregonians have been set up to fail by decades of underinvestment in programs that build healthy communities. The suffering on our streets that has led to Portland's doom loop discourse is rooted in problems that the mere presence of police cannot solve. Police cannot solve our housing affordability crisis. Luxury apartments sit vacant while people languish on waiting lists for affordable housing. Police cannot change the fact that Oregon was number 49 and 50 in the nation for substance use and mental health treatment access. Police cannot answer phones for the overworked case managers juggling three agencies to get their clients into housing. Police can't open a spot in a treatment program or give traumatized people therapy after years of sleeping outside. Police also can't watch your kids when the school day ends at 2:30 or 11:50 today, and after-school programs can cost hundreds of dollars a month. Police can't run summer camps, which can cost $300 a week and still don't cover a work day. Police can't unlock the bathrooms in a public park or clean them. Police can't give swim lessons. They can't staff our community centers. They can't make a sidewalk safer for a wheelchair or a stroller, and they can't fill a pothole. It is a fairy tale that policing combined with crowded temporary shelters can fill the void where a strong social safety net and affordable housing should be. Joyful, accessible community programs and spaces are crime prevention strategies. Please reject quick and brutal fixes disguised as safety and save the fairy tales for story time in a fully funded community center. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Casey Clapp, and I am representing the Urban Forestry Commission that I sit on. It's a volunteer group. The Urban Forestry Commission is deeply concerned by Councilor Zimmerman's proposed amendment to reduce urban forestry permitting and regulation staff from their current 37 positions to 5. If implemented, the additional reductions would have an immense negative impact on Portlanders today, and more importantly, Portlanders tomorrow. It would hobble the critical infrastructure services that urban forestry provides. The Urban Forestry Commission is a community advisory group that serves Portlanders by advising City Council on matters relating to urban forestry and trees. We're advising you now to reject this amendment and retain this critical work group so that core functions of the urban forestry program continue to serve Portlanders. Our urban forest, Portland's tree canopy, is widely seen across the nation as a hallmark of our city. Our tree code, Title 11, is often seen by other jurisdictions as the gold standard in municipal tree regulations. The praise and our nationwide reputation as an arboricultural leader were not earned by accident, and they do not persist without the efforts of the work group that is proposed to be cut. Briefings have been provided for each of you that explain the functions of each specialized team within this group, and I expect that those have helped make clear their importance to the healthy and efficient functioning of our city's urban forestry program. So again, we strongly urge you to vote against the proposed amendment to remove urban forestry's regulatory work group. This reduction will create frustration and unresponsiveness when Portlanders try to reach out to the city about a tree issue. It will damage our urban forestry and affect the livability of our city for decades. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Loretta Guzman. I'm the owner of Bison Coffee House. I was born and raised here in the city of Portland. I live in District 2 and my business is in District 2. I am speaking because I do want public safety as well as the need for property damages to cease. Our police force is small for a city our size, that there is not much presence, that crimes are taking place with no accountability. I am not in favor of the council wanting to control the PPB and fire budget for the overtime. Both these bureaus need to be fully staffed, so we don't need overtime. As overtime causes burnout and then people are leaving, some of you will not admit that we need public safety, as it is a fundamental right to we the people. Without public safety, I have experienced grave consequences, from my nephew being shot and killed to this day, no accountability. My property was just vandalized again yesterday morning at 1:25 a.m. No accountability. We have experienced common sense in the past, and therefore we know that what works, what gave us safety and a way to thrive. Last month in my neighborhood, I heard gunshots on a Saturday at 3:31 a.m. I went to open my eyes and I was immediately paralyzed. I couldn't move. I see all these amendments and the money involved and wanting to make changes or charge us more on our water and electric. It just keeps growing and no progress. Make the right decision. Give us life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Thank you.
That was testimony from today's marathon budget hearing at Portland City Council. The council hopes to have most of its budget amendments wrapped up by 11 p.m. tonight, but the meeting is expected to run late. Portlanders can still submit written testimony on the city's website through this evening. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm David Chitten.
We'd like you to meet a friend of ours who goes by the name of Killer Joe. Picture a so-called hippie or hip cat standing on a corner in a neatly pressed, double-breasted, form-fitting pinstripe suit, a pair of pointed-toed shoes with bold white stitches around the soles, a black shirt, long white tie, a black pencil mustache, and of course a very wide-brimmed black felt hat. Killer Joe always has a pocket full of loot, but only the kind that jingles. You see, he likes to play the horses. He is most certainly a ladies' man. As a matter of fact, he is always willing to accept cash contributions from them for any cause, namely his own. The most important thing about Killer Joe that you have to know is that he's very much against manual labor. Killer Joe.
Are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934